The Guardian.
Hello, this is a Science Weekly Extra podcast. I'm Alok Jha. This is the extended version of an interview with Fred Pearce about the ClimateGate emails. Cast your mind back to last November. You remember, just before the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit. You'll no doubt recall that a rather large hoo-ha was brewing, with some people claiming proof had been found of the existence of a global climate change hoax. It revolved around thousands of emails and documents stolen from some of the world's top climate scientists at the University of East Anglia. 7 months on, a new book claims that just about everything you may have heard and read about those emails is wrong. It's by one of The Guardian's regular environment writers, Fred Pearce. The book, The Climate Files, The Battle for the Truth About Global Warming, is out this week. Fred spoke to James Randerson, editor of environmentguardian.co.uk.
So, Fred, your book, The Climate Files, The Battle for the Truth About Global Warming, which from the cover looks a bit like an Andy McNab thriller, is out. Before we get into some of the issues, could you just give us a very brief rundown of the sequence of events surrounding these released emails?
Yes, one Friday afternoon, suddenly a whole mass of emails from the Climatic Research Unit of the University of East Anglia, there. Emails they'd sent and emails they'd received over 14 years suddenly appeared on the internet. Some of them looked rather critical, some of them looked rather dodgy, and a huge amount of discussion has gone on about them ever since. This was in the run-up to the Copenhagen climate talks. Whole series of inquiries have been going on ever since. A couple of them have reported, another one is about to report. But the debate still goes on. Did these emails reveal something nasty in the woodshed in climate science or not?
That is the question, indeed. I mean, some people have jumped on some of those quotes and said that it reveals some kind of global conspiracy to hide the truth about global warming, and that there's evidence of scientists manipulating data. I mean, perhaps first you could address that point and then go on and say, well, what do they really say?
Well, I've read pretty much all of the 1,000 emails, and there's quite a lot of data and other material there, but the emails are at the heart of it. No, there is no smoking gun suggesting a global conspiracy among climate scientists to delude us, to con us about climate change. There really, honestly, is no evidence of that at all. It simply isn't true. And yet, the claim is still frequently made because there are many people with an axe to grind here. There are bloggers, there are politicians, particularly in the US, who've tried to pick up on this issue. If you remember, quite a lot of the coverage concerned the claim that scientists were trying to hide the decline. It's a phrase that appears again and again and again in coverage. Hide the decline in global temperatures.
It's going to haunt Phil Jones to his grave, isn't it? The scientist at the centre of all this.
Absolutely, it will. It was in one of his emails to a colleague, Mike Mann. Now, that's three words out of one email out of 1,000 emails, but it's repeated and repeated and repeated. And basically, lies are told about it. The claim is made that the scientists were trying to hide a decline in global temperatures. Now, in the last 10 years, global temperatures have been quite stable compared to what before. So the suggestion is that they were trying to cover this up because it was inconvenient in their story about global warming. There's one problem with that. The email was written in 1999 at the absolute peak of rising temperatures. Followed the warmest year in the warmest decade, probably in the last millennium. And yet, the scientists are accused of trying to hide a decline in temperatures which didn't even exist at that time. I don't know what you do with people who will so risibly abuse the truth, if I can put it that way. Sarah Palin was on the case, hide the decline in temperatures. Senator James Inhofe, one of the most senior senators in the US, went to Copenhagen conference, said the same thing. Really, it ain't true, but You know, a lie goes around the world very, very quickly.
As Stephen Chu, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist in the Obama administration, said, you're entitled to your opinions, but you're not entitled to your facts. Mm. There are genuine issues, though, of concern at the centre of these emails. Otherwise, you know, the Guardian wouldn't have put so much effort through your work into looking into them. What do you think those issues are?
No, you're right. It's important to say there are a lot of lies have been told. I mean, my purpose in exploring this was to try and find the truth from the lies, because there were so many lies around, we had to nail those. But we also had to investigate exactly what was in the emails, what was being said. And there are some worrying things in there. Two areas, really. First of all, scientists trying to withhold data from their critics on the grounds that their critics would want to pick apart the data and reanalyze the data and suggest that it didn't show what the scientists thought it said. Now, in a world of freedom of information, that's kind of a difficult thing to do, and that basically is something which they shouldn't have been doing, and there's some questions about the legality of some of it. The other area of concern was whether the scientists, again, in dealing with their critics, were using their power as senior scientists, peer reviewers for the main journals, were using this power in order to silence their critics. And again, some evidence that they were doing precisely that, that they were trying to keep papers that criticized their own work out of journals, and that they were conducting campaigns, I think you would say, against certain journals that were publishing this kind of critical material. So again, it doesn't show scientists in a good light.
I mean, some scientists have responded to that, and actually, in writing the book, we gave scientists a lot of opportunities to respond by putting large chunks of it online and inviting comments from people, and some people chose to comment on the Guardian's website, others wrote blogs elsewhere commenting on it. So all of which has now been fed into the book. So I think the book is now a much richer and kind of complete experience because of the extra material. But yeah, some of the critique over the, particularly the peer review issue, is that you just don't understand how peer review works, and that what they were talking about in those emails was just keeping shoddy science out of the journals.
There's a grey area here between keeping shoddy science out of the journals and allowing a debate on science. I think probably the critical issue here is conflict of interest. If you have, in quite a small world of a relatively small number of scientists working a particular area, if you have one senior scientist who is responsible for reviewing and giving advice to journals about the publication of papers which directly contradict and challenge his own work, that there's a clear conflict of interest. There are a number of cases where Phil Jones and others were involved in that kind of process and were advising against publication of papers. Now, there may have been issues about the quality of those papers, but there was no evidence that they were, as I think peer reviewers should generally be, going back to the authors and saying, look, this doesn't work very well. Why don't you revisit this issue? What about this question that you've not really addressed? In other words, a kind of coaxing of good science out of papers. I think that's a proper thing that a peer reviewer should be doing, instead of which we read in the emails of how they're really boasting about getting papers that criticise them rejected.
I mean, do you think this issue of conflict of interest is unique to climate science, or is it a problem throughout science in the peer review process?
Oh, it's an endemic problem in science. You don't have to spend long in the canteens of science labs to hear people complaining about perverse peer reviews and people who are kind of using their power in the system to maintain their view about a particular topic. That certainly happens a lot. But the issues are greater, I think, when there are only a small number of people involved, and therefore only a small number of people perhaps equipped to peer review some papers. And I think they have a particular responsibility to be fair-minded under those circumstances. And also, I think, when the debates are about small sets of data, one of the critical things about any good science is to be able to replicate the findings. It's a cornerstone of science. Other scientists have to be able to replicate your findings. Now, in this circumstance, scientists are often dealing with large sets of data accumulated from around the world over a number of years. That's essentially the data that was being held at the Climatic Research Unit, global thermometer temperature data over the last 160 years. You know, there aren't a lot of, you know, all that data is really in one place. And nobody can replicate that data. Nobody can go off and collect a new set of data. The data is the only data that's there. So again, there are extra responsibilities to allow other people, other researchers, to analyze that data to see if they come to the same conclusions as the researchers who collected that data. And what we saw in the emails was a kind of attempt to stop that process. So effectively, you were shutting down the ability of researchers to replicate the analysis of that climate data. And that's, I mean, that's just bad for science. And I think you do see that problem, which I agree is endemic to science, really, in a particularly acute form in this area.
But this actually brings on to another critique from some of the scientists who object to your sort of analysis of what the emails mean, and that's over the sort of replication issue, because they say that the people who they were trying to restrict access to are people like Steve McIntyre, who runs a blog in the US called Climate Audit. And they said, you know, this guy is not interested in replicating data. All he's interested in is getting hold of anything he can to cherry pick, pick holes in it, look for little mistakes, generally be awkward, you know, not actually to push forward science in a constructive way, but to pick holes in a destructive way. They would argue, well, he's not a trained climate scientist, so what's his business in this field anyway? And they would say, you know, we're quite happy to share our data with genuine colleagues from other universities who were you know, really interested in getting at this issue. But that wasn't his motivation, they would argue. And they said that he deployed tactics that they certainly didn't like, such as, inviting some of the people reading his blog to submit multiple Freedom of Information Act requests, which, you know, led to a massive kind of administrative burden on the university. This is not part of normal academic debate, they say.
No, I mean, there are important issues here about opening up academic debate to people outside the academic mainstream. And I think those are issues which science as a community has got to address. In a world of internet, it is possible to share data on a much wider scale. It is possible to have different kinds of review processes. And there are many scientists who are, I think, now discussing, in the light of the ClimateGate saga, whether it is right to open things up in that kind of way, whether it would be constructive and useful to do it. I think part of the problem here was that McIntyre and perhaps some others got mischaracterized. The scientists came to regard them as the enemy. I mean, it really was a kind of war going on there, especially on these issues of access to data. And I think they were misguided in doing that. And there are many emails that show they regarded McIntyre as in the paid for by corporate lobbyists or political activists, somehow having a financial as well as an ideological axe to grind. And the truth really is that he is not one of those. I mean, there are people in the climate skeptical business who are precisely like that. McIntyre is not one of them. And part of the problem is, I mean, McIntyre is a data libertarian. I wouldn't say anything other than that he can cause trouble, that he's probably a difficult man to deal with. He makes quite a lot of demands on people. But actually, he is a nitpicker. But isn't that supposed to be what science is about? Science has to have room for the people, the awkward squad, if you like. Science really has to do that, because otherwise you don't develop a kind of rigor in your work. You have to have people looking at things. And there are a number of cases where McIntyre has, and people at the Climatic Research Unit would acknowledge this, has picked up on things that they'd missed in their research. But again, once you get into a kind of war, things can get a bit nasty, I think, and bad things are probably done on both sides. McIntyre was encouraging his cohorts from his website to make freedom of information requests, because he was being denied data that the Climatic Research Unit said he couldn't have because of confidentiality agreements, but wasn't releasing the confidentiality agreements. So he was asking his cohorts to start demanding these confidentiality agreements. And I'm afraid it turned out that there weren't actually very many of them. So he was on to something there. Very irritating, very annoying for all concerned, very time-consuming, I agree, though not probably as time-consuming as the university sometimes tries to make out. But, you know, you have to be, I think, open. I mean, there is a real issue here, I think, about how open the mainstream science community should be to people outside that mainstream. Should science as a community be a kind of priesthood where you kind of membership by having your PhD or whatever it is, being part of a recognized institution? Or should the amateurs, the bloggers, have access? And if so, how should that be arranged? I think the science community has failed to address that issue. I don't think it saw, for instance, coming down the track, the implication of freedom of information legislation for their work. And they now need to work hard to work that out. In many ways, I think Phil Jones and people were a kind of victim of a kind of vacuum of policy making here. It's not their fault in many ways.
Yeah. And of course, when they wrote these emails, they had no idea that some of the emails might be the subject of Freedom of Information Act requests in the future. Because
indeed, the Freedom of Information Act didn't exist when some of those emails were written.
So we've had two inquiries already, official inquiries, one from MPs, one from Lord Oxburgh into the science. We've got the Muir-Russell inquiry still to report. That was actually the first one to be set up and arguably the most thorough of the lot. What do you think is going to come out of that, and where do you think we go from here if you project forward? There's been an awful lot of talk about this, but what's actually going to change, if anything?
I don't think the reviews are going to get to the heart of some of these issues, like who should have access to data, what the rules of engagement over freedom of information should be, what do you do about conflicts of interest in peer review. I think they're looking at them a bit, and we'll see. Maybe the Muir-Russell report will have more to say on it than many of us suspect. But they've raised the issues. They're in the domain, and they're not going to go away. And the science community, I think, on its own, regardless of these inquiries, is thinking about these issues now. So I think it will take more time to work out. In a sense, the inquiries were a kind of holding operation. If you have a big problem, you set up an inquiry. And I think there was something of that about what was going on. Remember, they were set up, or two of them were set up by the University of East Anglia itself. And I think there was a kind of holding operation to say, look, we're doing something about that. So I don't think it's going to be the last word. The MP's report was quite interesting. It was rushed out, rather. But it ended up being quite understanding of Phil Jones and his problems, perhaps a little bit more so given how more than it might have been given how senior Phil Jones was. It kind of suggested that he and his colleagues were simply operating as scientists have come to operate. It might not be perfect, but that's what scientists did. And I'm not sure that's quite appropriate when you're dealing with a director of a major research unit. Perhaps you should ask for a bit more. But in any event, the MPs were much more critical of the university itself, how it handled freedom of information issues, how it handled the scandal itself by basically shutting up shop and telling its scientists not to discuss the issue. In my own opinion, that was a really bad mistake. If the scientists had been allowed to discuss what was in the emails when they first emerged, it would have been inconvenient and embarrassing for some of them, but it would have had a much better debate. But in fact, they were told essentially by the university not to talk to the media, or not to talk to anybody really about it, because the inquiry was going on. And I think that was a mistake. I think that misjudged the situation.
We don't know yet what the Muir-Russell will say, but the two previous inquiries, I mean, do you think, some people have suggested that they're a kind of whitewash. Do you think fair-minded people who, you know, don't have an axe to grind one way or the other, should regard them that way? Or do you think they're reasonably on the money?
I think they're going to be probably reasonably regarded as, if you like, insiders' reports, not people who were directly related to the research involved.
Even the MPs?
The MPs less so, though. I mean, they were kind of conciliatory and understanding about the science. But the two other inquiries were essentially by academics who knew very well academic methods and ways of working and perhaps weren't capable of standing outside sufficiently. And certainly the critics, the bloggers, have made a lot of supposed links between people. Sometimes, you know, somebody had worked at the University of East Anglia for a while and therefore perhaps should have been not part of an inquiry, that kind of thing. I mean, I think you can get a bit silly about that. You know, you have to take people at face value, I think, after a while. But so I don't think it will satisfy the critics. Certainly, I don't think it will. But I don't think they've been useless, and I think the inquiries have opened up some interesting issues, not least by holding oral sessions to interview people like Phil Jones, who, other than that, has not had much to say in public on the issue. So that itself was valuable.
And just finally, are we any closer to knowing who the hacker, stroke leaker, stroke releaser? There's a lot of contention over whether we should call this person a hacker or a whistleblower or not. Do we know who that person is?
We don't. We don't even know if a crime was committed. The police have been on the case for, more than 6 months now, and there is no evidence that they've made much progress. They've interviewed quite a lot of people, but they don't appear to have established anything very much that one could tell. For myself, I think perhaps the suspicion grows with time that it might have been some inside whistleblower, either sending the information out, the emails out, or perhaps putting them in a part of the university web server where it could be accessed by somebody. That's my conjecture. I have no evidence for that, other than the suspicion that if it was an outside sort of blogger, these guys are pretty noisy. These guys always want to make trouble and make claims. I think they would have owned up or claimed responsibility for this if it had been one of them. Maybe it was some clever corporate conspiracy in the run-up to the Copenhagen talks. That's still a possibility. My own gut feeling is that probably we'll never get an answer to this. But my gut feeling is that it was done by somebody inside the university who would obviously not want to own up because they'd probably lose their job in the process.
Fred's book, The Climate Files, The Battle for the Truth About Global Warming, is out on the 17th of June. But you can also hear him at the Royal Institution on the 14th of June, speaking about the book. And there will be some sneak early copies on sale too, which, if you ask him very nicely, he might even sign for you.
Fred Pearce there speaking to James Randerson. In the regular podcast this week on the same iTunes feed, you'll hear Professor Chris Llewellyn-Smith's thought on the whole saga. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast extra was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.